Welcome to yet another episode of Method in Madness, and today we are joined by Daniel Long, a change strategist who helps organizations break through resistance and drive transformation. From unlocking innovation to streamlining process, Daniel shares his insights on making change stick. So I can't wait to hear his mantras of change, behavior change, and more importantly, that little madness that drives him. Please help me welcome, all the way from Germany, Daniel Long.
This is Method in Madness.
Welcome to Method in Madness, Daniel. How are you doing today?
Good, thanks, Sammy. Good, thanks, Sammy.
Fantastic. So we've been connected on LinkedIn for a while. So this is the first time we actually get to meet each other. And I am, like I was just telling you, I'm so impressed by things you post, right? Always has a people perspective. But what I saw first thing on your LinkedIn now is that you're also a coach now who's helping consulting companies scale up. How did you end up there? How did you become a coach?
Yeah, so I have made a bit of a transition. In the last 12, 18 months, since I started posting on LinkedIn, throughout last year, 2024, I was doing a lot of posting, and people started asking me about how to grow on LinkedIn and asking for coaching or content coaching. And I started coaching them on their content, and I thought I better charge people because initially it was free.
Yeah.
Sort of charging people, and that still more people came, and to the point where it sort of became a business that I wanted to pursue. And I thought, look, I like this work. I love the coaching work, marketing work. And when I look back over my YouTube history, for example, for several years, it's all marketing and business related, entrepreneurship. And so I really thought I'm going to lean into this new world and put a stake in the ground. And so now I'm creating, it's a coaching business as well as an agency. So done for you, we're actually creating content for people. And also supporting, newly minted or small consulting firms who want to grow with content marketing.
So, okay, let me ask you a question that's always in my mind. You've worked with many companies, you've seen them. What are the three things people get right and they are on the path of doing it correct and path of scaling up? And what are the three things they do wrong that just stops the growth and just there's just... stuck basically and probably face existential crisis? What are the three things you've seen, both three good things and three things that damper the growth?
Yeah, maybe I'll start with the damping the growth. Look, the biggest hurdle to get over is actually product market fit. That is the really hard part. It is the absolute hardest part out of all of this, is to figure out what you're selling and to who and how to communicate that to that particular audience such that they will buy. That is by far away the hardest part out of this whole game. And so in terms of mistakes, it's like thinking from your own point of view about what you think people want. And so the biggest mistake is you need to actually get out there and have conversations with your target market, whoever you think that is, and then get the insights and actually see. The other one is number one mistake is not speaking, thinking internally and not speaking to this ideal client or target client that you're targeting. Number two is mistaking people's, that sounds like a great idea, for actual market. So we've got to get clear that will they actually pay you for something, or have they paid other people for similar services in the past? And which brings me to mistake number three, which is thinking that you need to innovate and create a whole new sort of offering. You don't. You need to communicate it properly differently, and you need to communicate why, what something unique you're bringing to the table. But for the most part, particularly in sort of services, consulting services industry, creating something completely new is not what's required. You actually need to create, you want to see for evidence that they've actually paid for this service in the past, so that you can validate that there is actually a market there. And the ultimate validation is they start paying you for it. And then you can string a few of these together such that you can go, okay, there's a momentum here, there is a world here that of which I can lean into. So they're the three big mistakes. And so the corollary of those is what people do well, which is speak to their market, validate the offering that they're actually paying for this market, not inventing something from new from scratch. We're not doing inventing the iPhone here. We are, we're very much in the marketplace of providing services that people want. And in summary, people who succeed, they are selling something that people want. You need an offer that people actually want to buy. And the offer is the most important part of all of this, which is your offer or what the tech companies in call product market fit. That is by far and away the hardest thing to achieve, and that's what you want to. You need to focus on that. And ultimately, I honestly think it takes about 12 months to 2 years to really sort that out.
Yeah, I think it, and it's also, I can speak from my own experience, it's always evolving because the world is changing and the demands and the dynamics is changing. Like I wrote once a blog that is 2024, the end of the soft leadership, because now the whole focus has shifted from the whole D&I to the sustainability to survival. And your product market fit needs to adapt to changing times, right? You cannot sell those kind of products that were such a vital things few years back, right? So you have to be also you can create something that works now, but it has to evolve with time, right? Otherwise,
Absolutely.
I saw a post. Maybe I think I saw it today when I was looking at your LinkedIn, and I really liked it. You talk about because you mentioned product market fit, the difference between a vitamin and a painkiller, which is that what are you selling? So when I first read it, it felt like okay, sell the painkiller because there's a quick market. There's like easy negotiation. But the last line said that when you sell painkillers, there's a long-term impact you can create. I speak from my own aspiration, and I know a lot of consultants who has a similar aspiration to create a long-term impact, not just solve take the fire down. How do you sell a vitamin in markets now when budgets are cut down? No one's looking to buy, put even an extra penny for even a coffee. It's all scrapped. Is there still a need for vitamins?
Probably not. If you're an up and coming consulting firm, I think you need to sell into the pain, or said more eloquently, sell into the need. You need to be a people need to have a clear and present need that you can fulfill. Then that's how you would provide the impact. Because when I was coaching people like in my employee days, people how do they want to get ahead? And I would say, you want to be working on the most important project for the organization. That is the key growing your career. It's the same principle. You want to be working on what's important to that organization. It's either going to make them money or save them money, and it needs to be very clear and tangible. And that is the key, is that if people have a need and they've got a problem and that you can solve it and you're there with the track record, then you will be able to get the deal. That is the key. It is absolutely key in all of this. People need to have a clear and present need. I don't then maybe you can talk to them about vitamins. But ultimately, I don't think it sells. I think you need to sell in. People need to have a clear need, and you need to be able to validate the ROI. And you only do that by selling to a need.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We also very briefly touched just before the call that change management and the world of change is something that you love. It's something that fascinates you. So what is it about change that you feel such a strong call and pull towards?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think all my life I've had an entrepreneurial kind of bent. When I was coming through my career, it wasn't quite like it is now when you can create businesses with the internet so easily. I sort of didn't have that available to me necessarily. But in the terms of my time in corporate, I always gravitated towards projects, creating something new, the excitement of that. And then, like you said earlier, I have a people angle to my disposition and what I was good at and what I enjoyed doing. And so organizational change became this kind of natural fit for me, where I was able to conceptualize and strategize at the beginning of a project and then see that through to implementation. But on the people side, like the technical side and the project management side, wasn't necessarily something that I was passionate about. Whereas I really enjoyed the people side, running workshops, putting together communications plans, distilling, how do we ensure adoption? People are ready and they're willing and they're able. I just really got behind all of that, really started to enjoy it and found that it was a growing niche. It was a niche, and it was somewhere that I could have an impact. And so I became a staunch advocate for it.
Yeah. And you still love it?
Yeah. Look, it's still part of my DNA now. Change is pretty much there. All of those skills are there in supporting now my clients create and grow their consulting businesses. It's the same skills. It's all of those things are really there, very clear and present for me.
One area that I am exploring and I'm very curious about is the workplace happiness, how to make people feel more engaged and connected to the work, like people feel happy to come to work and make a difference. Now, often, and I don't agree, but people say that the change is that one factor that often comes in the way to workplace happiness. Do you agree? And if you do agree, is there a way that change and happiness can coexist together, and how?
I think, yeah, absolutely. So projects and organizations impact people ultimately. Displacing people, people jobs changing, the way they work, their ways of working changing, their location changing, it's all people that we're impacting. And so we're impacting people. And obviously that has direct impacts on people's happiness. Some people will be happy about these changes, others won't. And we all know people resist change, and obviously, especially when it's thrust on to them from people that, from so when it's out of their hands, so to speak, in terms of the decisions that are made. So it's definitely a big issue for people. And I like, and happiness is a is a direct function of productivity as well. So happiness, change, and that fact that impacts employee sentiment positively and negatively really goes to productivity in an organization. And we all know that when there's change, productivity drops dramatically. And if there's reorganizations and people losing their job, well, productivity is going to plummet throughout that process. So, but we still have a business to run, we still have clients to serve.
Absolutely, absolutely. You've also worked in Australia and also in change. So I'm just curious, and I just thought of it. Is there a big difference on how change management and change projects are handled in Down Under versus in Europe?
I don't think so. No, I'm not seeing big changes. I think, the corporate wheelhouse is very global now. People move around a fair bit. I think one of the things about Australia is Australia seems to be fairly mature with respect to organizational change management. I think that's because of the dominance of the finance and banking markets in Australia, and the regulation that's surround that, and how that has, in recent times, different sort of for certain organizations and types of projects, mandates. I think that I forget the term now, but operational risk or risk and change at the time, which really supported organizations, making sure that they had proper organizational change to support their change initiatives, their projects. And so I think that's one thing about Australia is it certainly feels like a little bit more advanced in terms of maturity. Outside of that, I would say, the vagaries and uncertainties around change, people not fully understanding it, but, some organizations get it, some don't. There's a lot of similarities. There's a lot of similarities is what I found.
I have two more questions that I asked to all my guests. The first question is, and I think this is right up your alley. I asked everyone, based on your years of experience and your work you've done, if you get hired as vice president of change in a large bureaucratic organization that hasn't been changed, hasn't changed anything, no change management for years, and your first job is to change behavior so the change can be more easily embraced, what's the first behavior change that you will include in the organization, and how would you implement it?
What's the first behavior change? Can you give me a little bit more context on?
Let's say it's a large organization, 10,000 people. They love working in their old ways. They have, there hasn't been any process efficiency. There hasn't been any Big change. People, any leader who has come to make a change or shake things up, have, be gone in a burnout by the dust or is left. People just resist change too much. They like working in their old ways, and they want to get familiar with, say, new technology or new way of working or a new way of performing.
And so your question is, how would I approach that in the first instance?
What's the
Or
first behavior change that you would try to include in the team so that they become more open-minded to change?
oh, okay. Well, I think the first thing I would try to do is get them involved in decision making, some sort of decision making process, to the degree that there's a legitimate decision making process that they could get involved in. And I would want to architect that. So I think that's really important, is that people are engaged and they're pulled in, physically, to contribute to the design. I'd be very clear about what is changing and not changing, or what decisions are up for grabs and what isn't, and be really honest about that. And then I would involve people, as much as possible in that decision making and create co-creation process from the very, very beginning.
I think that's a really good thing, because in a lot of places, in my experience, people resist change because suddenly a bomb is dropped on them. They have no idea. They didn't see it come. They're not part of decision making. They don't think that decision represents them or their needs and their concerns. So that's one of the top reasons why people resist change, in my opinion. And yeah, perfect. One last question, and this is a little off topic because the podcast is called Method in Madness, and we have spoken a lot about methods. Let's talk about a little bit about madness. What has been that moment of madness in your career that you look back and think, oh my God, what was I thinking? But thank God I did it. Not sure if I'll do it again, but man, what was I thinking? The moment of madness, if you ever had one.
Oh, well, moving to Germany, that was a huge change. Changing careers and ways of working all in one. That was a big point of madness on reflection. Absolutely. And then changing again, pivoting again into this new way of working, new business that I'm doing. Like, that's also like just lots of change in a short period of time, 8 months, 2 years. Yeah, that's been pretty bonkers, I've got to say. It's still a journey that I'm working through now. The bell hasn't rung on that one.
Well, I am very sure it will be a tremendous success. From following you on LinkedIn, I see how passionately you post, and also you cheer for others who are in the chain space writing good content. It takes a person with generosity to praise others, and that's a skill of a person who is going to make a difference in that space. So thank you so much for sharing such a candid story, candid interview, and your mantras of change. I wish you all the best for your endeavors, because I know you're going to make a very positive impact both in change and in people scaling up their consulting. So thank you so much, Daniel.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Thanks, Eddie.
And that was yet another episode of Method in Madness. Together, we have now completed 4 years of podcasting and done over 60 episodes. Well, the drive to bring a change, a positive change, behavior change in an organization takes way more than 60 episodes. So we are in this journey. I hope you're enjoying the podcast. See you in a few weeks with yet another change, yet another method, and more importantly, much more madness. Because there is no magic without a little madness.